You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Gino Rodriguez. Gino, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hey, it's great being with you, Brainerd.
So, Gino, I want to talk about the Alternative Museum and a lot of things around that. But to begin with, what got you into the arts? And you can go as far back as a child, but what got you interested in the arts initially?
Well, actually, I was always somewhat interested in creative things, but I grew up in a poor family, so we didn't have access to a lot of cultural activities. And in fact, I never really even seriously went to a museum until I was like 20. But that's because I got a free education in England, which I couldn't get in the States. And I went to an art college there. And, of course, that opened up all kinds of doors and made me see the world in a totally different way. And so I did 40 years.
And in what sense? Let's just stay there for a second. So art college in England, you're looking at the world, and it opened up a lot of doors. In what sense? That sounds like an interesting point.
Not to get it too heavily into the social aspects, but I'm 75, so I'm pre-civil rights, and you know I'm one of those people that have been told to go back where I came from, and you know my school my scholastic achievements were tainted by a lot of the bad feelings that people like myself might have felt at that time. And going to England, actually, even before going to England, when I went to Morocco with the U.S. Navy, I realized that there was a whole different world out there, that people saw each other in a different way. And so eventually when I get to England, after having lived in Denmark for a while, a bit of a gypsy, I found that I could be myself and not who other people thought I was or thought I should be. And, you know, eventually that led me to, you know, London, where I went to college, art school or college, whatever it's over there. It's called at that time college. Now it's University of the Arts in London. And, you know, I met different people. I married my wife. I'm still married now for 47 years to an English woman. And that took me out of my barrio mentality, so to speak. I could see the world in a much broader spectrum. And after 4 years of studying art in England and then going to Denmark and being a painter and then leaving Denmark and coming back to New York eventually in 1969 or 68, I tried to, you know, get my work shown, and people kept referring me to a Museo del Barrio, and I would say...
You were trying to get your painting shown, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, I remember meeting... a curator at MoMA, and he's looking at my slides, and he was interested, but he thought I should go to the Museo del Barrio. And I said, well, look, either it's good or it's bad. If it's good, why are you referring me to someone else based on my last name? I mean, it's not like, I was by that time I was, I don't know how to put it, more urbane, sophisticated. I mean, I already learned to speak about four languages, drank my wine with upper-income people, upper whatever you want to call them. So it was kind of weird. And anyway, eventually, to get to one part of your question, I guess, I remember it all started with the idea that artists should take their own destiny into their own hands. And if the other institutions weren't opening their doors, or they were supporting the keep them on the ranch, keep them on the farm kind of ideology, the only way to get around it was to create your own, which is what I ended up doing.
Okay, so that's you're saying what the Alternative Museum, which we're about to talk about, came out of your own struggle with the art world and its system of I don't know what you want to call it, but kind of
exclusion.
Shoeboxing. Exclusion.
It was, look, let's be right up front about it. Back in the late 60s, early 70s, the art establishment was rather segregated. You know, you were either a white male or a white Jewish male, and maybe one or two females. But then that's basically what it was. And I don't believe in segregating black people or white people or yellow people or Jewish people or anybody. I just believe in presenting people that do good work. And that came out of my travels and my experiences all over the world. And when the Alternative Museum finally came into being, it was focused on, you know, creating a kind of united institution.
And how did that institution begin? I mean, that's a really noble idea, of course, and wonderful things happen. What actually happened at the beginning? How did the museum take off?
Well, they actually, I was given a number of opportunities that came up, because in 73, I was invited to put together a show for what was then called the New York Cultural Center, which was the Huntington Hartford Museum on 59th Street Columbus Circle. And that was considered a proper real museum. And I did a show there with a bunch of other artists. At that time, I was trying to find out who the hell I was. Anyway, that show was called The Islands, Worlds of the Puerto Ricans. And Dos Mundos, Worlds of the Puerto Ricans. And it was a photography show with about, I don't know, 12 photographers showing their existence, their way of life through their own camera lens. And that was shock. The big shock of that was that it got two Sunday reviews in the New York Times. It doesn't happen very often. And then NBC, CBS, ABC got onto it, and suddenly I was becoming a little bit of a somebody. And that allowed me to then think in broader terms. The Alternative Museum was then in a position to apply for grants as a not-for-profit institution. So we received funds from the National Endowment on the Arts and New York State Council on the Arts, and then Rockefeller Foundations and so on. And part of it was that I was kind of like the right kind of person to allow into their playground. Trying to be a little diplomatic here.
You can say anything you want, of course, but yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I sometimes one tells the truth, and the truth can sting, and so it becomes it takes on a negative response. And I don't want to be negative. I'm just, you know, this is just a history. The reality of it is that the doors were at a certain point, they were not open to everybody. And what we decided in 1975 was that we should have an institution that should, first of all, be inclusive of anyone that was making what we decided was good art, and that there should be a socio-political sting to it. And I think I should preface all of this by giving my definition at that time and still as to what art is. And I just see art as a reflection of a culture, and a culture as a reflection of the people's health, education, and socio-political well-being. And what we decided to do was to focus on the socio-political well-being aspect, which meant that we wanted to present artists that were disenfranchised at that time for whatever reason. So the first exhibition in 1975, much to the surprise of a lot of people, was 10 Japanese and Japanese-American artists, which, believe it or not, back then were not even then getting played. They weren't being shown. Today, you don't get an exhibition that doesn't have some Asians in it. Everybody thought that I should be doing exhibitions of Latino artists. And I said, I'm perfectly happy to do exhibitions with Latinos, but not because they're Latinos, but because they are, you know, good artists. But the political ploy at that time was, first you do the Japanese, then you do the African-American, then you do the Latino, then you, whatever. And by the end of the second year, exhibitions at our place looked like a mini United Nations reception. And then they got more political in terms of subject matter, so that we dealt with issues of poverty, AIDS, war, and so on, which is the reason why we thought of ourselves as an alternative. That is, what other people weren't doing, including so-called art spaces and so on, they were not doing. They were basically research and development organizations for the major institutions. And we
right,
saw
and
ourselves...
in a way, I mean, sorry to interrupt, but that's also the role of, as I see it, that's the way to use a nonprofit, to do something that's an alternative, counter to the market or other demands on artists, commercial galleries. It allows things like you were doing, political and social expression.
Which can be a problem, because if you're not for profit, you always have to rely on it's the begging game. You're always having to rely on people giving you money, and people give money to people. They don't give money to ideas. So if they don't like you, your idea can be the greatest idea in the world. You're not going to get funded. So if the subject matter that you're showing, I'll give you an example. I once did a show called Endangered Species, and I remember having lunch with a vice president from Philip Morris, who was very nice. He used to give us $500 a year from his personal community chest. And he said, "Gino, you have to be careful. You can't bite the hand that feeds you." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, today you're talking about, you know, animals and the forest, and you're talking deforestation, you're talking about all of these different things that endanger species. Tomorrow you'll be talking about cigarettes." And, I took that to heart. It was a very important thing for me to know, which, of course, I ignored.
Well, and then let me put this in perspective, because I think everybody knows who you are who are listening to this, but also as the person running the Alternative Museum, a big part of your responsibility was raising money and writing grants, I imagine, which is why you're having conversations and we're talking about people like this guy from Philip Morris. Is that correct?
Yeah. You have to raise – look, nonprofit is a kind of a weird kind of thing, because when you have a nonprofit organization, you still have to pay salaries. And you have to pay rents, and you have to pay all of the different costs that providing a functioning space requires, you know, whether it's insurance, temperature control, whatever. And it's always difficult writing grants, because it's always competitive. And people that are sitting on the panel, 9 out of 10 of them have a certain mindset. And if you come in with a mindset that says, "Listen, you guys aren't really doing the right thing. This is the right thing." Well, you know, it's not going to make them like you. You know, it's like, I remember the Gorilla Girls. You know, there they were whining and complaining and so on. What were they complaining about? That galleries were being run by men, and they were showing men, and they weren't showing enough women. So here the Gorilla Girls cover their faces so that nobody can see who they are, and then they complain because they want to be part of that faulty exhibition system. They want to be part of the Leo Castelli Gallery. They want to be part of the people that left them out, but they can't make the leap into coming up with a new paradigm. Let's not want a piece of the rotten pie. Let's bake a new cake, something new, and get away from what's wrong. Don't just whine about not being part, you know, getting a piece of the rotten pie. And that's partly behind the creation of the Alternative Museum, to create a new paradigm.
So, and in my estimate, it did create a new paradigm, and there was amazing shows there, and in music, I mean, all kinds of things we could talk about that really changed how people were looking at exhibits and brought groundbreaking things to New York. We can talk about some of it, but why did that end? And now you're at a situation where you're kind of, as you said just before we talked, kind of divorced from the art world. Why did that happen?
Well, I think by 2000, or actually by around 1995, 97, the powers that be in the art world decided that we were either a nuisance or a threat, and that we weren't doing what they wanted us to do. And so the money started to dry up after 25 years, which was okay, because that's, you know, life is cyclical. You know, I don't believe that you have to create a museum that lives forever. It's all cyclical. And the creation of the museum for myself, for Janice Rooney, and in the beginning Robert Browning, was really like making art. I mean, I remember doing a lecture once at the Mint Museum, and I had put together a show, and somebody asked me a question. I said, look, to me, the gallery is just a big canvas waiting for creative marks. I use artists, and I know I shouldn't have said that. It was politically incorrect, but I said, I use artists like tubes of paint. In the end, what's up on the walls is my statement, and every artist's work stands for itself. And, you know, the whole of the Alternative Museum was basically one big creative thrust to sort of say things can be different. The art world can be different, and through the art world we can make little tiny little dents in that world that we perceive to not be what we would like it to be. So instead of whining and complaining and being bitter about the art world, change it. Do something different. Create your own space. It just so happened that our space was not so much about research and development for the other institution. It was more of a challenge and a sometimes provocation for other institutions to take something from. I think they have.
I think certainly PS1 MoMA has incorporated some of those ideas at times in other institutions, don't you think?
I think so. But, you know, what happens, again, in the art world, everything is cyclical. Like, we went through this postmodernist period, which included, art that had content. Let me put it that way. But I remember when the Whitney did its exhibition, which was considered the Biennale, that was considered to be a political Biennale. As I was going in, another curator was coming out, and he said, "Oh, you know, you guys are finished." I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "Well, once the Whitney starts producing shows like using the same artists that you use, well, then you're no longer needed," and which was a compliment in a way for me. But at the same
time,
that
was the show with a Rodney King video in it. Was that the
political
show?
I think so.
I think that was about 96 or so.
Yeah, that's the one. And the thing is that, maybe we did become redundant, because I know eventually the art world just went crazy. You know, when we left in 2000, the art world became this place where people were just about becoming celebrities, especially the British, with the young British artists what they call conceptual art, which might be a little bit different from what they call conceptual art over there, really is art that doesn't have content, but alludes to something. So you get the Damien Hirst and the Tracy Emmons, and you get the Martin Creeds, and so you put up a glass of water on the on a shelf in a gallery, and you say, "This is an oak tree," and then everybody says, "Ooh, it's an oak tree." The guy gets $50,000 Turner Prize, or Tracy Emin's bed with prophylactics and bloodstains and garbage all over her bed. Oh, another $50,000 Turner Prize. And so in the end, you know, you get a Turner Prize. And I think this is, indicative of both sides of the pond, where you get an artist who has an empty room and the lights flicker on and then they flicker off. They go on, they go, that's another Turner Prize, $50,000. And, you know, I think that, you know, we've had our own share of this kind of work. And to me, this is all about the emperor's clothing, and the fact that academia and critics and intellectuals have gone so far to the point where the art itself is not important, but the idea, the problem is that if the concept is put together by a stupid or inept person, then the profoundness of that concept is, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's going to be a 2 or a 3. So then the marketers take over. And then, you know, the old conspiracy, the dealer tells the critic, I'm going to show this guy, and we'll tell the collector, and we'll all buy cheap, and then, you know, we'll make this star, and blah, blah, blah. And that is not the art world that I want to be part of. Not to say that I want to go back in time, but
is that why you're so to speak divorced from the art world?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I want to go back. If we should say back. I want to go forward to a time where art values in the visual arts were actually visual, and that there was an ability to produce work that had a profound nature, whether it was the idea or whether it was the craft, if you will. I'm just tired of the room with the flicking light that goes on and off, empty room, which Sir Nicholas Sirota at the Tate Modern actually purchased a room. Which they already
right. And Tino Segal, of course, is like that at the Guggenheim in New York. But let me ask you this then. I mean, that's one aspect of the art world. But to me, that's kind of like targeting the top traders in on Wall Street mm-hmm. that have ruined it for all the other traders. I mean, to make kind of a mm-hmm. weird analogy. But the mess. Mm-hmm. Of the art world, as I see it, is actually artists painting and drawing and making sculpture and doing things with their hands and struggling to get into the art world. But the people who are on the short list for the Tate Prize or who win it are kind of exceptions to the rule and perhaps not really the quote-unquote art world. It is that older time. It's just that what you're hearing about is the top. What you're talking about is really like the top 1% of artists, not the 99%, isn't it?
Yes, but that 1% came from that other group that you're talking about, of people that want to make art. But somehow the publicists choose somebody, whether it's the critic or the dealer, who they, you know, people are chosen. I can tell you stories about Jean-Michel Basquiat and Henry Geltzeller and Andy Warhol. I think everybody knows those stories. I feel that artists on the whole, when I say artists, I should say Western artists, American artists, on the whole, have bought into, let me put it another way. There was a time when we would be getting slides through the transom, and the slides were of a certain nature. And then suddenly everybody was doing work and submitting slides with glitter on them. You know, it's
oh, right.
Kind
you could see trends in a sense. That's interesting. Yeah, keep talking about that trends in a sense because of all the submissions you're getting.
Yeah, so the truth of it is that democracy, I'm going to get into hot water here, democracy in a way ruins the field, because what happens is anybody, now I also taught at Rutgers University and I also taught at the School of Visual Arts, and I can tell you that what happens is, if you have the I don't know what it costs now, $30,000, $40,000 back then to go to art school, you come out, you say, I'm an artist. That's it. Anybody can be an artist. And then if you want to go further back to Duchamp, you know, if I say it's art, it's art. And so the values become very blurred. The only way I could judge art was not whether it was good or bad, but simply, do I like it? Period. Because coming from the background that I mentioned earlier, when I first went to art school and I was told about and shown works by Jackson Pollock, I said, geez, you know, my reaction was, geez, you know, give me a bottle of whiskey. I can do this, you know, like everybody else in the working class might say. And then when I left college, and somebody said, oh, yeah, Jackson Pollock, he opened up the doors, you know, the freedom, the expression. And now I'm back to, you know what, I'm not so sure anymore. You know, I think Clement Greenberg and his cohorts, they made this man because they wanted to have an American art scene. They wanted to steal art away from, say, Paris or Europe. Anyway, I'm going in circles here.
That's okay. No, you're not.
Yeah, the bottom line in the end, Brainard, is that I ended up defining art like my illiterate mother did, you know, and that is, you know, you like it or you don't like it. She used to put up like labels on her refrigerator door of pretty flowers from a chocolate box, and she liked that, you know. And I think back on some graffiti that I saw on a wall in Denmark when I was living there in a jazz club, and it said, "Jazz is like a banana." And, you know, for years I tried to figure out what the hell does that mean? And I ended up with probably my own definition. You know, you take a bite and you either like it or you don't. You know, you don't need to be educated. You either like it or you don't like it. That's it. Jazz, you know, I took to it immediately. I just liked it. I didn't need to be told, you know, where it came from or how it evolved or where it was going. It's the same thing with art. I mean, I hate saying I'm a curator, because every Tom, Dick, and Harry, Jane, and Mary on the street today says, I'm a curator. I curated the show at the Bodega Window in the East Village. And I ask them, can you tell me what curator means? Define the word curator. And they can't. They just say, oh, yeah, I make exhibitions. So democracy, again, everybody's a curator. But the sad part is that so few of these people have any vision. And courage, you have to have both, because if you have vision, you're going to see what others don't see. They're not going to want to support it. You have the courage, you put it up on the wall. You make that exhibition, and you make people see your vision. Most of these curators that I worked with were doing the safe shows. If the person was well-known, if they were popular, yeah, put them in the show. You know, but and the same thing applies to critics. I mean, I can tell you anecdotes, lunch with people from the New York Times. Not the most brilliant people in the world if you take away art history from them. And you say, well, talk to me about this piece here or this thing as it is. Forget about, don't tell me that it looks like it came from this or that and it was preceded by this or that. Talk to me about this. And they start talking about the materials. So yeah, it's a disappointing art world for me, but I love doing what I did. I did it with Janice, who happens also to be my wife, and the concerts that we did when Robert was with us. I mean, at that time, the New York, the National Endowment of the Arts asked us to come to Washington to tell them what we meant when we said world music. What is this world music? We can't fund it because we can't have a panelist for Tibetan nose flute players and a panel for Cajun music and a panel, you know. And so we created a world music program that was outstanding. And again, it was part of this bringing into New York City, New York City's cultural heartbeat, bringing in some new rhythm, some new, you know, look, art is not just this. It can be this and this from all over the world. People are creating art. And some of the most interesting art was coming from people, you know, in Thailand or China. I mean, Chinese became really hip.
It was fantastic things were happening there. I mean, do you think that that's also what should be happening now? I mean, as the art world is, as you see it, there's also just people coming out of art school. There are people who don't go to art school that want to be artists. There are people who think like you're thinking now that you know, want to be artists and are looking for the next step. Do you think the process ideally still is, just because you're on that right now, kind of trying to create a new time and build your own institution somehow?
I think it takes a special person, people and a special environment and time to do these things unless you have a huge trust fund. I was around at the right time in the right place. I was what federal government, state government termed a Latino, and look at this Latino. He's, you know, it's not blowing my horn. It's like I belong to the world. All my friends live all over the world. I mean, it's awkward and it's a strange thing, but you know, I was the kind of guy that could be presented and spoke, quote unquote, their language or could speak their language. I think it's extremely difficult, especially since the reverence for art, which I grew up with once I started going to art school, where you know, we were even too embarrassed to say, I'm an artist. The most you would say was, I'm a painter or a sculptor, or I want to be a painter or a sculptor. That reverence is gone. Everybody just wants to be celebrity. Just look at Damien Hirst, and you'll get an idea of, I mean, the guy's now amassed close to $400 million. And if you do a little research into his history, you'll find that his dead animals, his the skull with the diamonds, all that had been done before, and in some instances by people that knew him, or they were friends. So it's very, very hard for younger people who go to art school where the teachers are wearing the mantle of the emperor's new clothes, and kids go there and they don't really, they're being taught, but how can I put this? It's like the blind leading the blind. They're not being made to actually not look but see, and to think for themselves, to be judgmental, to be able to say, excuse me, Mr. or Miss So-and-so, I think you're wrong. Tell me why I think you're wrong. Tell me why you think you're right. To be, not to just look at things and say, oh yeah, this is what's happening, and then absorb it and then produce more of the same stuff. It's hard to even get a conversation over a dinner with people who can actually converse and have a solid understanding of what's happening in the world. And let me give you a little aside here, which I think is interesting, and goes back to a question you asked earlier about what happened and how it ended and so on. Part of our problem was that we felt that there were certain injustices in the world and that the United States was part of them. Consequently, we did a number of shows, one in particular, which was called Occupation and Resistance. And we were funded, and we took 15 American artists ranging from Jewish American to Arab American to actual German to African American to the whole spectrum to Palestine. And we said, look and come back and we'll do an exhibition. And we did. That exhibition created a situation where people were sending us notes, wishing us cancer, rape, wishing for my family, torn up membership cards, but no real debate. And when we had the panels discussing this particular show, they wouldn't participate. And I found out through sources, I mean, once you've been in business for 25 years, you have people. And people were saying, you know, that the museum is anti-Semitic. And we said, no, we just feel that if you talk about El Salvador, Nicaragua, South Africa, the Roma, and so on, you don't exclude that which is most obvious in American politics. And that, you know, really, really got to people. And we started losing our funding in part because of that. Regardless of the fact that we did shows with people who did works about the concentration camps, that we showed Israeli artists. That didn't matter. What mattered was that we did a taboo show. But it's like Leon Golub, a very lovely man. I really liked him. I asked Leon one day, Leon, how come you show, you paint about Nicaragua and El Salvador and South Africa, but you never touch on the issue of what's going on in Palestine? He said, well, you know, I'm a Jew. What can I tell you? So it's kind of like, you know, suddenly I feel, oh, my good colleague, Leon, can I keep on respecting this kind of thinking? Because injustice to one is an injustice to all. You don't make exceptions. So that was that. I think that played big in the demise of the museum. But also in the end, you know, cyclical, you know, we did our thing, and that was that. Ouch.
Gino, it's been a pleasure talking with you. I want to thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, you're more than welcome, Brainard.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.